Good morning.
Lord willing, in about a month's time, I will be making a preaching trip to the country of India. And I am tentatively scheduled to leave November 3rd and to return on the 17th. I will be with Brother Dan Torres, a Christian whom I have known since my days back out in the state of Washington. And it will be my second trip there, the first one being in 2007. So it shall be nearly a decade since I've been out there. But for a good number of years already, the brethren there that I had come to know had been pleading with me that I might be able to come back and return. And Brother Dan Torres himself has very often inquired if I could rejoin him, for he has gone several times since that first trip in 2007. So towards that end, I would like to bring a lesson here on the subject of Hinduism. Hinduism, which is the primary religion that is found over in India. So that we might begin thinking about this potential upcoming trip, that you might know of my travels and what challenges are going to be faced and what it is that we're going to encounter as we bring the gospel of God's dear Son over to this part of the world. I've titled this study, The Darkness of Idolatry, Hinduism in India, What I Saw in India, and Why We Need to Keep Preaching There. And I want to start by looking over at Romans chapter 1, Romans chapter 1 and there verses 18 through 25. We have a cornerstone passage on idolatry that is recorded right here in Romans chapter 1. The Apostle Paul says it thusly, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, His invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify Him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, and birds, and four-footed animals, and creeping things. Therefore God also gave them up to uncleanness and the lusts of their hearts, to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie, and worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen." Now this is a hallmark passage on idolatry and what is found with it. And I want you to see here the three different C's, the three different C's that the Apostle Paul addresses with respect to idolatry. He points out first the cause. It begins with people being unthankful, ungrateful in their hearts, not content with the one true and living God. And then he talked about what constitutes it. What constitutes idolatry? Changing the glory of the incorruptible and eternal God into an image that is perishable and material. And then last, he discusses the consequences of idolatry. God therefore does what? God therefore gives them up. He gave them up. So you have the cause, what constitutes it, and the consequences. The three C's of idolatry, all here within one passage. But I'd like for you to pay close attention now to a form that Paul said it could take. Examples, at least, of what forms it might take and manifest itself. He talked here about four-footed animals and creeping things. And dear ones, if one were to travel over to India, you would see all manner of wildlife. They have the Brahma bull. Monkeys are found over there. They have elephants. They have snakes, like the cobra. And let me tell you this right now, and I kid you not, that for every one of these animals that you see pictured here, they have an equivalent in stone or in wood that is worshipped. These are photographs that I myself took on that first trip out there. And we were out there for a relatively brief time. So you don't have to go all that far in that country to see these idols that are worshipped and revered. They have a cow god, a monkey god, an elephant god, and a snake god, together with many, many other gods. You see, it's easy for us, I believe, to think that the idolatry that was characteristic there in biblical times, the idolatry that was found particularly there with the Old Testament, that it's largely extinct today in the world. But friends, that is not so. Unfortunately, it is alive and well in many parts of this world, much like it had been there with the Hebrew children of old, and they had to struggle with that. India happens to be a land of idols. It surprises some to learn that there are monkeys that are seen out there. They're not necessarily as common as cats and dogs, but you can be certain that they are not afraid of people at all, and they will come up to people, and people that are out there do not take a second glance at noticing the monkeys. When we had made a drive out to Kurnool to do some preaching there and to train gospel preachers, we stopped along the roadside there to step out and stretch our legs. We still had yet a long journey ahead, and right there by that roadside, we found some monkeys. And one of the preaching companions here took the liberty to give that little monkey there a snack. Something to munch on and nibble on. Monkeys are out there. And inasmuch as the monkey is there, perhaps it is no surprise then that they have, in fact, a monkey god. They call him Hanuman. Hanuman. And he is one of India's most popular gods. He is worshipped every Saturday and Tuesday. His temples are found all over the place out there. And he is believed technically by Hindus to still be living on the earth today. Now, they don't know where that is, but they're persuaded that he is out here in this world. Hanuman has an interesting story. Now, first, Hindus believe that a warrior race of monkeys once existed. Now, careful, let me throw in this disclaimer. They do not believe in evolution. They do not believe in the traditional theory of evolution that was promulgated by Charles Darwin. But they believe that at one time in the distant and ancient past, there was a warrior race of monkeys that could talk and interact with people. And they were equipped with swords and shields and spears. And Hanuman, they say, was one amongst that warrior race. Now, what they say of Hanuman is that when Hanuman was younger, he actually, get this, swallowed the sun. Swallowed the sun. You heard that right. They say that he looked up one day and he saw that sun, and he interpreted it as a juicy piece of fruit, much like an orange. And so he decided to leap up and gobble it up, and he swallowed it whole. And so there was darkness all over the earth, and they tell you even that the whole universe turned dark for a period of 3 days. And there on that third day, the other gods were upset. They were disappointed. And so they approached the mother of Hanuman, and they said, "Look, your boy here is unruly. We've got the people on earth, they're complaining, they're frustrated, they're irritated over how it is that they have no sunlight to enjoy. So make your son spit the sun back out." And he does so. And we must be thankful, see, because we have the sun today. Now they believe that. All of that is very fanciful, but this is what they believe. And understand this much, that when you're looking at the population of India, you're talking about a population that is at least about four times the size of our population here in the United States. On our drive from Bangalore to Kurnool, I saw here a large stone statue of Hanuman, an idol. And in New Delhi, the capital of India, they put up a 108-foot statue of Hanuman, 108 feet high. He towers above the monorail that you can see right over there. Now, India is a poor country, but a lot of the money, a lot of the resources go right into the production of idols and those temples. This is why we need to go out there to do gospel preaching. And as you might suspect, they have their education programs. One could purchase a DVD about, say, the story of Hanuman, and this is then in turn shared with the children. So there, at a very young age, they're taught that Hanuman really existed, and that he does exist, and that he is real, and that he is to be prayed to. Make no mistake, this is happening even at the present. Ganesha, the elephant-headed god. This is one of India's most popular gods as well. Worshipped with flowers and incense every day. In fact, he happens to be as a mediator between mankind and various other gods or goddesses. You see, if you're wanting a better situation with your job, you might have a particular god that you pray to. Or if you want help with your academic work, your schooling, there might be a different god that you would pray to. But whatever god it might be, maybe you want more peace and harmony in your home or with your family, there'd be a particular god that you might pray to. But with respect to whatever god that might be, the idea is that you're supposed to first go through Ganesha right here. His temples are found all over the place. His human head had been severed by his father, and an elephant head was put in its place. Let me give you the backstory here, if I might. You notice the one with the blue-colored skin here. This is their destroyer god, Lord Shiva. And the story runs like this. You're looking here at a family. You're looking at a family. The story runs like this. That Lord Shiva was away from his house, out in battle. And his wife, a goddess, decided to take a bath there at the house. But she wanted her privacy, and so she wanted to have some protection. So what she does is she takes the dirt from her skin, and with that dirt, she fashions a little boy. And she places that little boy there at the doorway, at the entrance, so as to safeguard against those that pass by. Now Lord Shiva returns from the battle, and he encounters this boy, having never met him. So he pulls out his sword, and it's pretty violent here, but he lops off the head of this boy. Now his wife, this goddess, is distraught. So she says, "What have you done? You killed my son. You killed our son." And he confesses his ignorance about all of that. He was surprised. So he sends out some of his servants. And he tells his servants, "I want you to find the first living entity, the first living creature out there with its head pointing towards the north. And I want you to take off that head and bring it to me." So they go out and they find this sleeping elephant with its head pointed towards the north. They decapitate him. They bring that head back to Lord Shiva. He places it there on this child and breathes into him the breath of life. And there you have Ganesha, one of their most popular gods over there. When we were taking taxis to a drive from one preaching appointment to another, about all the time you could see this right there on their dashboard, they would have a Ganesha idol sitting right there. Much like if you were to, I don't know, take a taxi over in New York City, you might see a statue of the Virgin Mary on the dashboard. We have our idolatry here in our country, but they've got their idolatry over there. And how fanciful this is. They have a custom, they have a practice, a ritual, yearly, of taking a large Ganesha idol, sometimes upwards 30 feet in height, and they will parade it through the town, they'll parade it through the city, down the streets, and there's a lot of cheering and chanting. And they're going to come then to a body of water, perhaps a river or perhaps even the ocean, and they will dump this idol off there. And the idea is that that idol, Ganesha, is supposed to be taking all of the troubles, all of the anxieties, all of the worries that the people had confronted in that year away with him on his own journey. Now, inasmuch as Hinduism is found here in our country, it's no surprise that here within our bodies of water, we have the Ganesha idol. This is a picture from Kawanesk Lake in Pennsylvania. In Pennsylvania. And there, what do you see? Right there within the waters. Ganesha. You can make out the elephant ears, can't you? You can see the eyes that are there. This is here. Now, as you might suspect, those with the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, are alarmed by this. They're bothered by it. These idols you see are made out of plaster of Paris, and so that's going to dissolve. And when it dissolves, it's going to release some toxins there into the water, like mercury. And so you have the environmentalists. You have the people there that specialize in the safety of our water that are perturbed by this. They don't want to see that happen, but here it happens due to this religion. We ask the question, why is it that with Hindus, they do not eat beef? They're not going to have steak. And that is because the cow is sacred to them. They have a cow god, Nandi. Nandi happens to be the sacred bull upon which Lord Shiva rides, according to their stories. And as we were there in Bangalore was where we had flown into. It wasn't too far from the airport there that we passed by a temple that was dedicated to Nandi. It's called the Temple of the Bull, and you can make out the horns there, right there at the entrance. Now, we did not go into this temple, but what I did with my camera is I zoomed in as best I could to get a picture of the idol that people were approaching there within that temple to go and see and worship and burn incense to. We did not go in, even as, say, like tourists, because of this reality that what they would do, what they insisted upon with everyone that was going to enter into this temple, is that they would put a red dot on your forehead. And that red dot would indicate to anyone else that saw you that you were Hindu in your religious beliefs. So you can see we did not want to lend any credence to this idol, so we did not go in. We did not have any of that done. But I zoomed in here so that I could get a good look at what it was that people were worshiping there. And you can see the garlands, you can see the flowers that this image is draped with. And make no mistake, big business is out there in the front. Big business at that. Idols all over the place. Idols, idols, idols. You can get them by the bagful. You can get them by the bushel. It's a very profitable, lucrative business over there. And I got to confess to you, it reminded me of the Apostle Paul as he went there to Athens to preach the gospel. What does it tell you as he entered into that city? What did he witness? What had he seen? What had his eyes laid upon? When he saw that the city was given over to idols, his spirit was provoked within him. And so he's going to be reasoning with the people there, reasoning daily there in the marketplace, teaching them about the errors associated with idolatry. Shiva is the destroyer god there in India. He, along with Vishnu, the preserver, and Brahma, their creator, are regarded there as the divine trinity. Now, if you were to go to India, you're going to find that there are a lot of temples to Shival and Vishnu. They get far more attention, they get far more press than Brahma. And I asked about that, and they said, well, the reason is because creation has already been done. Creation is already completed, so we still have to live in this world. This world needs to be preserved. That's why we worship Vishnu, and the world is ultimately going to be destroyed. So they worship Shival very frequently. There in Bangalore, we encountered a 65-foot statue of Lord Shiva. 65 feet! I mean, you think about the monuments that we have here in the States. Say like the Statue of Liberty. We're talking about objects that are rivaling the sizes of many of our precious monuments. But we commemorate something special with that statue. But over there, they worship that statue. And they worship a god or a goddess behind that statue. And you can see right here in front of this statue of Lord Shiva, they have a fire pit where incense is burned routinely and regularly. Lord Shiva wears a snake around his neck. Looking there at that passage in Romans chapter 1 once more, did we latch on to what is often connected with idolatry, the moral vices that are there? They're going to be doing those things which are not fitting, according to the Apostle Paul. And among those things that are not fitting, there's going to be some maliciousness that's manifested, murder and strife, evil-mindedness. Now, why am I highlighting these particular words? I will show you precisely where I'm going with this. As unthinkable as it is. Now, let me tell you right now, to modify this and clarify. I'm not saying that this happens in the larger cities. Not necessarily. But as you go out there into the remote places, distant places, yes, occasionally you hear about even human sacrifice. One of our translators, Brother R.S. Rao, he went into great detail this procedure there with me. He said when a Hindu constructs a building, and that can be for commercial or even personal use, he will ask a Brahmin priest to bless his building. And sometimes that Brahmin is going to say, the building cries out for human blood. And so consequently, as tragic as this is, at times, children have turned up missing in India. He even explained that a poor Hindu man, knowing that he cannot provide for his wife and children, may freely offer himself to the builder, a wealthier man, in exchange for the promise that his wife and children will be cared for after his own sacrifice. I tell you this. This is real. This is an excerpt from the Washington Post. Now, this was just a few years before my first trip out there. I did some research, and sure enough, all of this was verified. All of this could be accounted for. After a rash of similar killings in the area, according to an unofficial tally in the Hindu Times, there have been 25 human sacrifices in western Uttar Pradesh in the last 6 months alone. Police have cracked down against this, jailing four and forcing scores of others to close their businesses and pull their ads from newspapers and television stations. The killings and the stern official response have focused renewed attention on bizarre sadistic practices that grew out of Hinduism. Police in Korea say dozens of human sacrifices have been made over the past 6 months. Last month, in a village near Barha, a woman hacked her neighbor's three-year-old to death after a Brahmin promised unlimited riches. It's sickening to even read this, isn't it? In another case, a couple desperate for a son had a six-year-old kidnapped and then, as the Brahmin chanted mantras, mutilated the child. The woman completed the ritual by washing in the child's blood. How disgusting, how horrendous. Unthinkable for us, right? And yet it happens. It's because of blind superstitions and rampant illiteracy that this woman sacrificed this boy, said Kurja police officer Ak Singh. It's happened before, and watch this. and will happen again, but there's little we can do to stop it. How awful. What will people do in the name of their religion? See? In most situations, it's an open and shut case. It isn't difficult to elicit confessions. Normally, the villagers or the families of the victims do that for us. That idolatry that was there in the Old Testament, that included, in some cases, the passing of children through the fire to that false god, say with the cult of Baal, it's found even today. It's found even today. That's why we need to go over there to do some teaching, to bring people out of that darkness that's connected with idolatry and into the light of the blessed gospel of God's dear Son. I need your prayers for that. We need to be thinking about this. Yes, Hindus can be taught. Now, it's easy for us to look at this now and scratch our heads saying, we've got a situation over there where you have people that do not have the Bible. They do not have the Old Testament and New Testament that they can read. They do not have that Bible there as their standard of authority. So where do we begin? How can we go about this? Where is the common ground to start making some inroads in? Well, we have a good example with the Apostle Paul going over there to Athens. And it was said there about Athens that it was easier to find a god in Athens than a man, meaning that it was easier to find an idol than a man. When you're looking at just how populous even that city was, now that was the capital there for ancient Greece. A lot of people were there. It was a hub of trade and commerce, and yet it was filled from one end to the other with idols, and yet the gospel could go even there. But there in Acts chapter 17, verse 22, he uses an altar to an unknown god as the platform to preach them about the one true and living God. We sometimes have to be a little innovative and creative, but we can teach. And there in verse 28, he quotes from their poets. Did you catch that? Now, this is a quotation taken from a Greek known as Epimenides, who was several centuries before the first century. And he was the one who had said, technically, in him we live, move, and have our being. That was not original to the Apostle Paul, but he was quoting there their poets. Now, contextually, watch that. Contextually, Epimenides spoke about the chief of the Greek gods. He did not believe in Jehovah. But Paul took his statement and applied it to who? To Jehovah, the true and living God. Zeus was an idol. That was their chief god. And so that statement that was made there about in him we live, move, and have our being, originally it was applied to this false god. But Paul had done his homework. He knew his audience, and he knew how to redirect them in the right direction. In verse 29, watch how he appeals to common sense and reason. And I think about the words of the prophet Isaiah there in Isaiah 1, verse 18. Come and let us do what? Come and let us reason together. The battleground is that of the mind, the intellect. Sometimes we don't want to fess up to that, but that's so. And so we must talk about Christian evidences. We have to show this world why it is that Jesus is the answer. And that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. And that no man is going to come to the Father but by Him. And that can be done as we dig our heels in and think critically about the task before us. But there in verse 29, he said, therefore, since we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, something shaped by art and man's devising. Now, let's run that by ourselves once more. What is he doing right there? He is using what we refer to as logic. Logic. You see? If God happened to be an object of gold or silver, or if he happened to be stone, then we should be like gold or silver or stone ourselves. Because Your poets have pointed out that we are as his offspring. So you see, he's stepping them through this logic here, showing them the irrationality of this, showing them how it is contradictory. You follow that? That's what he's doing. He is appealing to the intellect. He said, therefore, since we are the offspring of God, we ought not to think that the divine nature is like this over here. We have to get people thinking in the right direction, don't we? He appeals to the mind and to our recognition that truth does not contradict itself. So, for instance, when you're talking there about Hinduism, perhaps one place to start, going back there to like Hanuman, this warrior monkey race that allegedly existed, we could ask the fundamental question. Where is any proof for that? Show us the great buildings that they allegedly built. Show us their armor, their swords, their spears, their shields. They know that they cannot do that. No such attempts have been made to produce any of that. We can utilize elements of a foreign culture to teach people about the one true God. I'm going to share some examples here. Were you aware that Hindus have a flood story in their scriptures? Yes, they do. You see, according to their version of it, a god appears to Manu in the form of a fish and warns him of an impending flood. Manu then builds a huge boat which houses him and his family. He has 9 types of seeds and animals to repopulate the earth. Make no mistake, the flood stories that are found across cultures are bona fide proof that a cataclysmic worldwide flood, in fact, did happen. And we can talk about stories that are found over there, say in South America, stories that are found over in China or in the Polynesian islands. There's variations, but you can see the common thread about a worldwide flood and deliverance for a particular family. Hindus have a concept of God coming in the flesh. They believe that it has occurred many times. In point of fact, Vishnu has already arrived here 9 times, according to their religion, and will come one last time. Hindus believe that washing purifies one spiritually. So ironically, now think about that part right there. While it can be pretty hard here in our country to talk to people about baptism being necessary for the remission of sins, because of the baggage that comes along with denominationalism, that we're saved or justified by faith alone, over there in India, you don't quite have that baggage there. And they're more inclined to accept that they need to be submerged in water to have their sins washed away. Hindus believe that a warrior on a white horse will come to signal the end of the world. Kalki, the last incarnation of Vishnu, will bring the end of the world, and he's going to ride on a white horse, so they say. So what we're going to have to do as we go over there is we point out that no, that's not Vishnu, that's not Kalki there. But the Lord Jesus Christ is the chosen of God. And when he comes, he shall come for his own and deliver up the kingdom to God the Father. There's hope for the future. You're looking here at gospel preachers over there in India, working very hard, incredibly hard, to spread the word of truth. When we were there at Kurnool, at the Jiva Sudha facility, we trained a good number of gospel preachers, nearly 170, and they're doing their work today. We brought Bibles over in great abundance. A lot of money went towards that end right there. And we take for granted just how available this is for us. We really do. But over there, you sometimes have nearly entire congregations that don't have but perhaps 1 or 2 Bibles, tops. Bibles are needed over there in their hands. You're looking at now going out to a baptism in Hyderabad, India. Some of the temples there in the distance are about 1,000 years old, ancient. But you see hungry hearts, open hearts, honest hearts, people that are tender and wanting to learn what's right. They just want the truth. Having little in this life, they eagerly look forward to the life to come. And we can learn some lessons right there. I'm reminded of the words of the Apostle Paul to the church at Thessalonica. For they themselves declare how you turn to God from idols to serve the living and true God. For this reason, we also thank God without ceasing, because when you received the word of God, which you heard from us, you welcomed it not as the word of men, but as it is in truth, the word of God, which also effectively works in you who believe. We're turning people from the darkness of idolatry to the light of the gospel of Christ. And yes, we have that commission. It's a divine mission that's given, a mandate from on high, from the highest authority possible, God the Father and the Lord Jesus Christ. We are to go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. He who believes and is baptized shall be saved. So where do we find ourselves? Let's make sure that we are in God's house, in God's family. And how do we get there? We have to be baptized into Christ. And then resolve to work hard for Him. Give your dead level best to grow in the grace and knowledge of the Lord, to be productive, abounding in the grace and knowledge of God, so that heaven can be your abiding and eternal home. We want that for you. Become a Christian today. If we can help toward that end, please come down to the front where we stand now and sing.